Okay, imagine this. You're in this like really intense legal battle. Maybe it's, I don't know, a family feud over an inheritance, something like that. And your lawyer, they've been working on a settlement offer, but you're not like completely okay with all the details just yet. Then all of a sudden the other side is saying, "Nope, you've settled. This is done." And they're trying to like enforce this agreement you're not even sure about. So can they actually do that?
That's a really good question.
So that's what we're going to be diving into today, the whole world of attorney authority. And what happens when things get, well, a little messy? We're going to look at this through a real case, Ackerman v. Sobel Family Partnership, decided by the Connecticut Supreme Court back in 2010.
Interesting case.
I think this deep dive is going to be super helpful for anyone who, wants to really understand how these legal principles we talk about so much actually play out in real life.
Yeah, I think so too. And it's especially important, so we can all avoid those pitfalls in our own practice, right? I mean, this case is fascinating because it really gets at this concept of like apparent authority, which is basically saying it's not always about what's explicitly stated, between the attorney and their client, but more about the actions and behaviors, like what leads other people to believe that that attorney actually has the power to act on their client's behalf,
I see.
even if they don't.
Okay, so let's sort of set the stage for everyone listening. So we've got this family, the Sobel family. They are in a huge legal battle over trusts and partnerships.
Lots of money at stake.
Yeah, exactly. And some of the family members, including a woman named Rena Ackerman, are claiming that others in the family, they breached their fiduciary duty. I guess just for anyone who might not be super familiar with the term fiduciary duty, it basically means that someone had a responsibility, like a legal responsibility, to act in the best interest of those other people.
Yeah, putting their interests ahead of their own.
Yeah, but according to the lawsuit, they didn't do that. So Ackerman and these other plaintiffs, they hire a lawyer named Glenn Coe to represent them.
Okay, so this is where things start to get a little complicated. So
What?
Ho, the lawyer, starts working on a settlement with the defendants, right? He thinks he's really close to something called a global settlement, meaning it would like wrap up all the lawsuits all in one go.
Makes sense.
But you probably guessed it, Ackerman and some of the other plaintiffs, they later come back and they're like, wait a minute, Coe didn't actually have the authority to settle on our behalf.
Wait, so their own lawyer settled the case without them actually giving him permission?
Well,
How is that even possible?
Well, to understand that, we have to look at how the court applied what's known as the Tomlinson test to figure out if Coe actually had the apparent authority to settle the case.
Okay, so this Tomlinson test sounds like a big deal.
It
Can
is.
you like break that down for us?
Yeah, sure. So think of it like this. It basically boils down to two like key questions that the court has to answer. First, did the clients, and legally they're referred to as the principals, did they act in a way that made it seem like their attorney, the agent, had the authority to settle?
Makes sense.
And the second question, did the other party, legally the third party, did they reasonably rely on that, appearance of authority?
So it's not just about what was said directly between the lawyer and client. It's like how they acted in front of everyone else.
It's all about perception, right? Like what message their actions were sending. And in this specific case, the court actually found that the plaintiff's actions, specifically Ackerman being there at some of these settlement talks but not objecting, gave the defendants a reason to believe that Coe could actually settle the whole thing.
So just by like being there, being present, she might have implied consent. That's kind of the slippery slope, isn't it?
It can be. And that's where this idea of silence as consent comes into play, which is always tricky, especially when you're talking about like high stakes legal negotiations. The court basically said, look, the defendants relied on the plaintiff's actions, or I guess inaction, in good faith. They genuinely believed that Coe had that authority based on how everyone was acting.
Okay, so then what does this mean for everyone listening?
Yeah, good question.
For lawyers, for clients, does this mean that like silence always equals agreement?
Wow.
Should we all be like terrified of accidentally agreeing to something that you really don't want?
Not necessarily. It's a little more nuanced than that. There's more to the story here. See, the court also considered that during these negotiations, Coe did occasionally tell the defendants, you know, hold on, I need to check with my clients.
Okay, so he wasn't like going completely rogue. He was at least checking in sometimes.
Exactly. And this is where it gets really interesting. The court actually saw these statements as like boosting Coe's credibility.
Really?
Yeah, because it showed a certain level of transparency.
I see.
By admitting he needed approval on some parts of the settlement, it, like, implied he was being trustworthy on the other parts.
Oh, okay. So, like, being upfront about your limitations can actually work in your favor?
Yeah.
It's kind of, like, the opposite of what you'd think.
It is. It is. And I think it just underscores that, like, clear communication, consistent communication is just absolutely key.
Yeah, of course.
Both between the attorney and their client, but also with the opposing counsel. Right.
Yeah.
Just got to be on the same page.
Okay, so we've talked about how the court determined that Coe had, you know, apparent authority to settle this whole case. But the plaintiffs actually argued they were entitled to a jury trial.
Yeah.
To dispute this.
Yeah.
So did they get that chance?
So that's another super important point in this case. When we're talking about enforcing a settlement, legally that's seen as what's called an equitable remedy.
Okay.
Which basically means the court is trying to figure out, like, a fair solution.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than just sticking to those strict, you know, legal rules. And the thing is, with equitable remedies, you don't always automatically have a right to a jury trial.
Okay, so in this specific situation, because the defendants were asking the court to make the plaintiffs stick to this agreement that Coe made, it was a judge, not a jury, who got to decide what was fair.
That's right.
Interesting. You mentioned earlier that the court took Coe's, like, good reputation into account when they were making their decision.
Right.
That seems, I don't know, a little subjective, doesn't it?
I mean, you're not wrong. It definitely raises some interesting questions. Like, how much should a lawyer's past behavior actually influence, you know, how the court sees their actions in a current case?
Yeah, it's almost like that halo effect, you know, where a good reputation might make someone's actions seem more reasonable, even if they're kind of pushing it.
Yeah.
But then doesn't that raise, like, ethical questions?
It absolutely does.
Like, does having a good reputation basically give you more wiggle room to, I don't know, maybe bend the rules a little bit?
Yeah. It's a tricky area for sure.
Yeah.
Because on one hand, you want lawyers to be zealous advocates for their clients, right?
Of course.
But on the other hand, they absolutely have to be ethical and transparent in how they operate. It's about finding that balance.
So how do you strike that balance? Like, how do you make sure you're advocating effectively, but not crossing those ethical lines?
I think this case actually gives us some helpful guidance on that.
Okay.
Remember how we talked about Coe saying he needed to check with his clients?
Yeah, yeah.
That ended up being a really big factor in the court's decision.
Okay.
Even though it seems kind of counterintuitive, right?
Right.
Admitting you don't have the authority on everything can actually make you seem more trustworthy on the things you do.
Interesting. So honesty, even about limitations, can actually be a strategic advantage.
Absolutely.
Huh.
It goes back to that transparency we were talking about. Being upfront about needing that client approval, it builds trust with the other side.
Yeah.
They know you're not trying to, you know, pull something sneaky.
Yeah, that makes sense. But then wouldn't that also make you seem less powerful? Yeah, you know, when you're at the negotiating table, if you're always like, oh, hold on, got to check with my client, mm-hmm. wouldn't that make your position weaker?
I mean, that's the art of negotiation, isn't it? It's about finding that sweet spot.
Yeah.
You don't want to constantly be running back to your client for every little thing, but you also don't want to give off the impression that you have unlimited power. You know?
Right, right. It's a tough line to walk.
It is.
It is. Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground here. We've talked about the Tomlinson test,
yeah.
How apparent authority can have a huge impact on settlements, and, of course, all the ethical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into Ackerman v. Sobel, what are, like, the big takeaways? How should this case change how lawyers practice? What can our listeners learn from all of this?
Well, I think one of the biggest impacts of Ackerman is that it really shines a light on how important clear and direct communication is between attorneys and their clients.
Yeah.
It's not enough to just assume that your client understands how much authority you have or that staying quiet equals consent. You have to be proactive.
Right.
You have to set those expectations right from the beginning.
So it's not even enough to, like, have a good relationship with your client.
Yeah.
You really need to spell everything out.
You really do. Think of it like, you know, a safety net.
Okay.
Attorneys should document everything related to their authority, get informed consent from their clients for any major decision, and just make sure everyone is on the same page throughout the whole process. That way, you're way less likely to have these misunderstandings later on.
That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, we've talked a lot about the ethical considerations here, too. This case really showed how that line between being a zealous advocate and just being honest, it can get really blurry.
Yeah.
So have you seen any changes in how lawyers approach their ethical obligations since this case?
I think Ackerman definitely reinforced how important ethical conduct is, especially when it comes to these settlement negotiations. Lawyers, they have a lot of power, and they need to be really careful not to use that power to pressure their clients or mislead them or even the opposing counsel. The focus should always be on a fair outcome, not just winning no matter what.
Yeah, I think that's a message that goes beyond just the legal world. You know?
Absolutely.
In any field, it's important to remember that your reputation matters, your integrity matters. Winning shouldn't come at the expense of your ethics. So any final words of wisdom for our listeners as we like wrap up this deep dive? What's the one thing you want them to really take away from our conversation today?
I think the biggest takeaway is that legal matters are almost never black and white.
Yeah.
To be truly effective, lawyers and clients, they need to really understand the nuances of all these legal principles, communicate openly and honestly, and always, always consider the ethical implications of what they're doing.
Well said. This has been such an insightful deep dive into a case that really has some far-reaching implications. We've learned about apparent authority, the Tomlinson test, the importance of communication, ethical considerations. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Okay, so we've talked about how the court determined that Coe had, you know, apparent authority to settle this whole case. But the plaintiffs actually argued they were entitled to a jury trial to, like, dispute this. So did they get that chance?
So that's another super important point in this case when we're talking about enforcing a settlement. Legally, that's seen as what's called an equitable remedy, which basically means the court is trying to figure out like a fair solution rather than just sticking to those strict, you know, legal rules. And the thing is, with equitable remedies, you don't always automatically have a right to a jury trial.
Okay, so in this specific situation, because the defendants were asking the court to make the plaintiff stick to this agreement that Coe made, it was a judge, not a jury, who got to decide what was fair.
That's right.
Interesting. You mentioned earlier that the court took Coe's like good reputation into account when they were making their decision.
Yeah.
That seems, I don't know, a little subjective, doesn't it?
I mean, you're not wrong. It definitely raises some interesting questions. Like, how much should a lawyer's past behavior actually influence, you know, how the court sees their actions in a current case?
Yeah. It's almost like that halo effect, you know, where a good reputation might make someone's actions seem more reasonable, even if they're kind of pushing it.
Yeah.
But then doesn't that raise like ethical questions?
It absolutely does.
Like, does having a good reputation basically give you more wiggle room to, I don't know, maybe bend the rules a little bit?
It's a tricky area for sure, because on one hand, you want lawyers to be zealous advocates for their clients, right?
Of course.
But on the other hand, they absolutely have to be ethical and transparent in how they operate. It's about finding that balance.
So how do you strike that balance? Like, how do you make sure you're advocating effectively but not crossing those ethical lines?
I think this case actually gives us some helpful guidance on that.
Okay.
Remember how we talked about Coe saying he needed to check with his clients?
Yeah, yeah.
That ended up being a really big factor in the court's decision.
Okay.
Even though it seems kind of counterintuitive, right?
Right.
Admitting you don't have the authority on everything can actually make you seem more trustworthy on the things you do.
Interesting. So honesty, even about limitations, can actually be a strategic advantage.
Absolutely.
Huh.
It goes back to that transparency we were talking about, being upfront about needing that client approval. It builds trust with the other side. They know you're not trying to, you know, pull something sneaky.
Yeah, that makes sense. But then wouldn't that also make you seem less powerful, you know, when you're at the negotiating table?
Well,
if you're always like, oh, hold on, got to check with my client, wouldn't that make your position weaker?
I mean, that's the art of negotiation, isn't it? It's about finding that sweet spot. You don't want to constantly be running back to your client for every little thing, but you also don't want to give off the impression that you have unlimited power, you know?
Right, right. It's a tough line to walk.
It is. It is.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground here. We've talked about the Tomlinson test, how apparent authority can have a huge impact on settlements, and of course, all the ethical stuff.
Yeah.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into Ackerman v. Sobel, what are, like, the big takeaways? How should this case change how lawyers practice? What can our listeners learn from all of this?
Well, I think one of the biggest impacts of Ackerman is that it really shines a light on how important clear and direct communication is between attorneys and their clients.
Yeah.
You know, it's not enough to just assume that your client understands how much authority you have, or to assume that staying silent means they consent. You have to be proactive. Wow. You have to set those expectations right from the beginning.
No, it's not even enough to, like, have a good relationship with your client.
Yeah.
You really need to spell everything out.
You really do think of it like, you know, a safety net.
Okay.
Attorneys should document everything related to their authority, get informed consent from their clients for any major decision, and just make sure everyone is on the same page. Throughout the whole process that way, you're way less likely to have these misunderstandings later on.
That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, we've talked a lot about the ethical considerations here, too.
Yeah.
This case really showed how that line between being a zealous advocate and just being honest, it can get really blurry.
Oh, yeah.
So have you seen any changes in how lawyers approach their ethical obligations since this case came out?
I think Ackerman definitely reinforced how important ethical conduct is, especially when it comes to these settlement negotiations. Lawyers, they have a lot of power, and they need to be really careful not to use that power to pressure their clients or mislead them or even mislead the opposing counsel.
Right.
The focus should always be on a fair outcome, not just winning no matter what.
Yeah, I think that's a message that goes beyond just the legal world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in any field, it's important to remember that your reputation matters, your integrity matters. Winning shouldn't come at the expense of your ethics. So any final words of wisdom for our listeners as we, like, wrap up this deep dive? What's the one thing you want them to really take away from our conversation today?
I think the biggest takeaway is that legal matters are almost never black and white to be truly effective. Lawyers and clients, they need to understand the nuances of all these legal principles we talk about, communicate openly and honestly with each other, and always, always consider the ethical implications of what they're doing.
Well said. This has been such an insightful deep dive into a case that really has some far-reaching implications. We've learned about apparent authority, the Tomlinson test, the importance of communication, ethical considerations. It's been great talking with you about all of this.
It's been a pleasure.
To everyone listening, thanks for joining us for this deep dive. And be sure to check out our next episode, where we'll be tackling another fascinating legal case.